music. You're always there for us when we need
to. Sets the tone.
Get out the next episode's outline. Set our mics into position. We really appreciate you hanging out with Kanya and I for a doubleheader tonight. Just covered for Instrumentality. And now it's time for our show. The one and only Chasing Sound, bringing you down the dark alleys of fringe music and hopefully bringing you back alive and a little bit enlightened. A little bit more aware of yourself as a human being.
Oh, yeah, right. We're going to do all that in just
as if
50 minutes.
Someone as rich and varied as yourselves could ever be encapsulated by one set of mixed songs that supposedly tell a story. Tonight, we're talking Matador Records, one of my favorite labels. It's not to say they're my favorite label or anything like that. It's just, like I was saying earlier to Kanya, if you came of age in the 1990s and at that point where you sort of separated and segregated yourself from your parents' music or the music from the previous generation, classic rock, things like that, one of the first labels that were, and this is what I called before big internet, you know, before like big pharma, before big internet had your whole world of music available at your fingertips, you really had to decide what you were going to spend money on. It meant a lot. Like if you were a poor kid from a poor family, which according to the numbers, most of us were, when you got a little bit of money together, mowing a lawn or some birthday money or however you got your hands on a little bit of cash, what tape or CD or album you bought meant a lot, because if it stunk, you felt really hurt. It was almost like getting dumped. It felt so bad. So you started looking for these record labels that were money in the bank, labels that consistently 80% of the time or better put out something that was worth your time and worth your money. And Matador was one of those first labels I came across. I know I saw the head of Matador. He was in a documentary about the band Half Japanese called They Would Be King. I saw him in there and he had the most articulate and just steadfast way of describing the band Half Japanese and how you couldn't be a weak-hearted person and listen to something that insane. It's like Daniel Johnston. Like it's not easy listening or Cat Power. You need to be able to handle stuff that's a headier brew than your typical George Michael tune or whatever. No diss against George Michael. I like some of his stuff. But Matador was just one of those labels where you just knew if you threw down your 10 to 15, you know, towards the end before the whole Napster thing kicked in, God, this, I remember paying close to $18 for a CD back when it was heartbreaking. Like that was 3 or 4 hours of my minimum wage job to buy a CD. And a lot of people feel like that was the death of the record industry. It wasn't Napster. It's that when confronted with either Napster or spending your food budget for the week on a CD, people were like, no, like you messed up. You quadrupled the price of, I know, the bass player from the Wrecking Crew band out of LA, the famous session Wrecking Crew, the girl who played bass on, you know, the Pet Sounds and stuff. I forget her name. Carol K, maybe?
Carol K.
Yeah. She said it was the record industry's fault because she said she watched it go from an LP being $3 to $5, and it just kept going up and up to where it was out of the reach of young people, high school, junior high, college. And if you make it out of their reach and then somebody else comes along and says, how about free? Like, what do you think's going to happen?
Right.
You know what? Can't figure it out. What's going to happen if they just, it's either that or they don't get to listen to some cool music other than what's on the radio. And at the same time, FM radio and all its magic is dying. It's becoming just this commercial enterprise churning out this, you know, it's only so many times you want to hear Life in the Fast Lane by the Eagles. It's like, please, can I hear something else? So anyway, digressing here, Matador Records, to get into the nuts and bolts of it, they were created in 1989 by Chris Lombardi in his New York City apartment, where all great things happen in someone's apartment. So Lombardi brought in this Austrian duo called H.P. Zinker into a studio called Wharton Tears Fun Studio to record the very first Matador release, which was titled And There Was Light. So Lombardi continued to add artists to the label's roster. Some of the early bands that were almost like the house bands at Matador that you just knew these were like Matador's people were Dust Devils, Railroad Jerk, who's got to be the longest running Matador band out there, and then Superchunk, who then went on to start their own indie label dynasty, which I'm going to cover at some point, Merge Records. Mm-hmm. You know, Merge, all the best Spoon albums were released by Merge. Just killer stuff. Arcade Fire, you know. another great label in their own right. But for a while there, Superchunk, before becoming the owners of their own amazing label that's been going 25 years strong now, they were a Matador band. And so the label went through a couple of business switches. They started partnering with different companies. You need that in the early days for distribution. You can't do everything out of your New York studio apartment. So they did some work with Homestead Records in 1990, and they sort of linked up with a guy who formerly ran that company named Gerard Cosloy, I think is the way you pronounce his name. And the two of them have sort of run Matador ever since. The label had its first big taste of success when they had the North American release of Teenage Fan Club's debut album, A Catholic Education. Do you remember Teenage Fan Club?
No.
They were a very fun band, and they were, I wouldn't say a hit, but they were on 120 Minutes. They did okay. Saturday Night Live. They were Alex Chilton from Big Star. They were one of his favorite bands. He talked about them a lot in interviews. They sold some records. Not everybody remembers them, but they were kind of movers and shakers pre-grunge. We're talking 1990, so before we had our Pearl Jam and our Nirvana fix, or at least in a kind of way where everyone had heard of them. Those bands existed, but in a, you know, a small local scale. So Teenage Fan Club was on the big stage playing Saturday Night Live. And so that was the first sort of money band that the label had, which gave them the juice to move on to some bigger things. In 1992, they released Pavement's debut album, Slanted and Enchanted. I can't believe all week long when I was putting the set list together, I had a song from Slanted and Enchanted on this playlist. But as I kept editing, it was like, man, it's just not going to fit tonight, but it seems crazy to me to not play Pavement on Matador night, because if there was any band that's super synonymous with that label, to me, it would be Pavement. And what an important band, too. You know, I wouldn't say they were ignored in their time, but they were definitely like Sonic Youth early on, where you really kind of had to be in the know to even be aware of that band. Luckily, grunge came along, and then suddenly every record store and every mall in the whole country started stalking bands like Pavement, because they're like, I don't know what these kids like anymore. Let's just give them everything from these little minor labels. Let's just suddenly sign them to distribution deals and get them into every shopping mall, which is how I got a lot of my collection in high school, is because it rode on the coattails of grunge. So moving on from that, their next big money release was Liz Phair's critically and commercially successful debut album, Exile in Guyville. One of the most important indie rock albums of all time by anyone's measure, safe to say, or certainly by my taste.
And a favorite of mine as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, if you like ambitious music and just killer singer-songwriter material done in a crispy, kind of a lo-fi, very heart-to-hand style with no BS in between, Liz Phair's Exile in Guyville, just, you almost can't ask for a more perfect record. And so long, too. I love how there were rumors for years that it was a song-to-song response to Exile on Main Street. And It does have the exact same number of songs, but I think that's kind of BS.
Yeah.
It's like, what a weird way to approach an album. But it is funny to think that rumor existed for well over a decade. I also didn't have any Liz Phair on tonight's set list. It's funny, I love talking about this label and all the acts that have made it huge, but when it comes down to making a playlist for a show, it has to have an independent narrative besides just the stuff you're spewing out of your mouth, you know?
Mm.
So Exile in Guyville, and then from there, the label had some real money, made some real partnerships that lasted for a long time. In 1996, Capitol Records purchased 49% of the company, so a 49% stake in the company. Labarde and Cosloy actually bought their shares back in 1999, so that was about 3 years running neck and neck with a major there. Beggars Group purchased 50% of Matador in 2002 and took over the label's worldwide marketing. That still exists to this day. One of my favorite things about Matador is how goofy they were. I loved that they had an interesting website in the late 90s when not a lot of labels bothered to make interesting websites, and they would just flat out lie. They did this all the time. They would put up band bios that were completely fictitious. And because it was the early days of the internet, or at least it was new to a lot of people, if you weren't like a hardcore computer nerd, they would put things like, my favorite thing they wrote about Spoon. When they signed Spoon, they just loved Spoon. They would write like, you know, we think Britt Daniel's the best songwriter. If you know a better songwriter, let us know, because we'll sign them right away. And they had this Spoon bio where they said they were misinformed when they heard Spoon's demo and they thought it was the Christian rap band DC Talk. And so the two owners of Matador say that they spent the next several months going to church lock-ins and Christian rap concerts trying to sign DC Talk before finally figuring out that the name of the band was Spoon. And it was written so plainly and so specifically that everyone believed it. It was hilarious that everyone was like, yeah, did you hear? They were going to church lock-ins trying to sign DC Talk? Like, how big of a mistake did they think they made? You know, and just that was typical of their band bios. And then in 1997, they released a compilation, which I still have to this day somewhere. It was a two-disc set called What's Up Matador? And there was an accompanying VHS documentary. I say documentary. It was like a kid's movie or a kid's show. They had basically they filled an auditorium with kids ages like 6 to 12, maybe. And then they got a guy who was like a game show host to come out and be like, hey, kids, do you want to know what's going on with Matador Records? And they're like, yay. And little by little, they break down the different bands on Matador and try to explain kids. Like they have questions like, how do you write a song? Like, how do you make a record? Like, just stuff like that. Like, why are some songs stupid? And they would just go about answering these questions. And it's like, so this is a rat pedal. It makes distortion. You also need to get a job that'll let you go on tour. We recommend fast food jobs like Long John Silver's. And it was just the most silly thing you had ever seen. But the compilation album was amazing because it was 2-hour-long CDs that they sold for like $6. I mean, it's been out of print forever. Probably pay a fortune for it now. But at the time, before a lot of people were downloading, it was like, that's very nice of you to give us something for $6. And the first disc was album tracks from the hit bands from their roster at that time, 1997. The second disc was unreleased tracks from all those same bands. So you bought it for $5.99. The first CD, maybe you already had half those band CDs, but the other half were like, oh, I haven't checked these guys out. And then you get to the next CD and it's like all your favorite bands from the first CD have songs you can't get anywhere else. So it was just, it was such a nice gift from that label. And to sell, I can't imagine they made a penny on it, selling it a double album for, you know, $6. I'm sure they did it just to help out their fans.
It's
and
promo.
Yeah, and it's just to get you excited, but they put a lot into it. And I could not believe they made that silly, silly movie to go with it. To this day, when I think about it, I can't stop laughing. So it's good stuff. I got a lot out of that compilation and it helped further my appreciation for this label. And they went on to have so many great bands. They were at the front of the line for releasing post-rock. And we're actually going to get tonight's set started with some post-rock. This is the opening track from Mogwai's 1998 or 99 album, Come On, Die Young. So Matador was on the cutting edge of some very cool electronica, hip-hop, and of course, post-rock. They weren't the original label that bands like Mogwai signed with, but they handled their U.S. distribution. So to those of us living in the U.S., we thought of bands like Mogwai very specifically as Matador bands. So we're going to kick it off tonight with this cool, creepy little track that opens the album, Come On, Die Young. This is a song called Punk Rock.
Well, I tell you about punk rock. Punk rock is a word used by dilettantes. And heartless manipulators about music that takes up the energies and the bodies and the hearts and the souls and the time and the minds of young men who give what they have to it and give everything they have to it. And it's a term that's based on contempt. It's a term that's based in fashion, style, elitism, Satanism, and everything that's rotten about rock and roll. I don't know Johnny Rotten, but I'm sure he puts as much blood and sweat into what he does as Sigmund Freud did. You see, what sounds to you like a big load of trashy old noise is in fact the brilliant music of a genius, myself. And that
that music is so powerful that it's quite beyond my control. And when I'm in the grips of it, I don't feel pleasure and I don't feel pain, either physically or emotionally. Do you understand what I'm talking about? Have you ever felt like that? When you couldn't feel anything, and you didn't want to either. You know? Like that.
Some critics.
Do you understand what I'm saying, sir?
Thank you.
So much fun. From the 1997 album Mag Earwig, that was Guided by Voices.
Nice.
There was another rumor that went around whenever Matador signed Guided by Voices in 1995. It was said that Matador dropped like half the bands in their lineup to be able to afford Guided by Voices.
Is that true?
And we never knew if it was true. It's a weird thing, though, that this band Guided by Voices, what you've got is a guy who was a kindergarten teacher in his 30s who quit being a kindergarten teacher and put a band together and just went on the road from like 86 to the early 90s and just slowly built this following doing this incredibly lo-fi music. Just imagine if Daniel Johnston's recording techniques were used for like the Replacements or some incredible rock band, and people just loved this band and just couldn't shut up about them. They were building all kinds of buzz. They were on this label called Scat, and Matador heard this band and they're like, we've just got to get our hooks into this band. They're so good. And they ended up giving the band a 5-figure budget to record their Matador debut. And the band just recorded it on a 4-track machine at their house and probably spent that 5 figures on beer. Knowing this band, I remember talking with the drummer from Spoon, Jim Eno, at a party once, and he said they went on tour, one of their first tours, because they were signed by Matador. Matador put them together with Guided by Voices to go on tour, and Jim said he'd be driving the van at like 9 a.m. going from one town to the next, and the guys in Guided by Voices would wake up and immediately reach into the cooler and start drinking beer. And he's like, oh my God, this band is so rock and roll. It's just nonstop drinking. I love Guided by Voices. I saw them once at a Waterloo in-store. And if you've ever seen that, it's just the tiniest little stage. It's like putting a band into the smallest room in your house. And most bands will shrink down their sound for an in-store. Like, oh, we'll play acoustic instruments or something. They'll shrink it down. Guided by Voices brought full Marshall stacks, a cooler full of beer. I think they smoked cigarettes, which you're not allowed to do. There's like sprinklers in there. And they just played like they were Van Halen playing the US Festival in 1983. The singer, Robert Pollard, doing big kicks, big high kicks in the air. Like he's just the front man for The Who or something. And the indie rock world just appreciated that there was a true rock and roll band. Indie rock had become very kind of dorky, kind of like these, anemic dudes, which is fine. Most of us were into that stuff too, but it sure was fun to see a real rock band, which is exactly what Guided by Voices was. So that track, I Am a Tree, it's actually written by their guitar player at the time, Doug Gillard. So the classic lineup of Guided by Voices had sort of come to an end right before this record happened, Mag Earwig. The singer Robert Pollard had expressed a desire to record with some new people, so he got himself a new band together, which, if I remember correctly, he just poached another hot band at the time called, I think, something Verde, maybe even Salsa Verde. They had some name that made me hungry, I remember that. And he made this incredible record. It was the last one they did for Matador before they got scooped up by a bigger label the very next year. But they released three and an EP or two for Matador. It was Alien Lanes, Under the Bushes, Under the Stars, and Mag Earwig. And most people consider that to be their best arc, or the most powerful Guided by Voices albums. And they were like the Kiss Army. They had their own army. If you were at a bar and you heard one of their songs come on, you the Guided by Voices fans would look at the bartender and kind of nod their heads. It's like, yeah, we know. It's like the Kiss Army, but intentionally funny. Like, not funny in a way that Kiss didn't mean for it to be funny. So in 1999, Radiohead put out an album, Kid A, which I'm sure you remember. Most people remember.
Yeah.
A lot of people like to think of it as the album that sort of put a fork in 90s rock and officially pronounced it dead. But it didn't come out of nowhere. So whenever Radiohead had put out that album, a lot of people were asking, it's just like, is rock and roll dead? Where in the world did you come up with the inspiration for this record? And people had asked the same thing of Pink Floyd when Dark Side of the Moon came out, like, what is this? This isn't rock and roll, whatever. All the usual stuff people throw at you. And Tom York cited several influences. There were these electronic groups coming out of these weird little, populations of like 2,000 or less, little podunk communities in England, where these kids had nothing to do, so they started making this weird electronic music, like Aphex Twin, groups like that, and it was just weird, weird stuff. And they were all seeming to come from one incredibly tiny, boring community where most of the population were cows. And Thom Yorke got interested in these groups, and these groups started to become movers and shakers. Of course, you know, John Peel started playing some of these groups, and it just sort of, as the 90s moved on, they became more a part of the cultural soundscape. And the next artist we're about to play, Jaga, he was sort of the kid brother. He went to the same university as the guys in Aphex Twin and some of these other groups. He came along a few years after the fact, but he put out a couple of albums in the late 90s that Thom Yorke specifically cited, saying, this guy was a huge influence on what you're hearing on Kid A, because the guys in Radiohead were no longer looking to rock or guitar-driven bands for their influence. They were looking to these madmen who were using those early Apple computers. You remember the Apple computer where the monitor was the computer, but it would be like red and look like a teardrop? God only knows what little processing power they had, but these guys were making incredible records using, you know, they would take Casio keyboards and rewire them and glitch them out and just come up with this insane sound that no one had heard before, and then editing it all on these primitive Mac computers. And they started a revolution. It changed everything. Think DJ Shadow. Think of what Radiohead became. And then all of a sudden, it was just no longer cool to have a loud distorted guitar and a Marshall stack behind you. That made you the opposite of cool at some point. You know, of course, everything comes back. But for a minute there, things really seemed to change. So this next track we're going to play, and Jago had signed to a European label, but again, the reason that Americans like myself have heard of him because Matador picked up the albums and released them stateside. So we thought of him as a Matador guy. If you go looking on the wiki, you'll find, oh, he was already signed by a UK label, but that mattered in the UK. What mattered to us was who put the record out here. And in this case, it was Matador Records. The track I'm going to play is from the first full length that Jaga put out, though he had a couple of very strong EPs before this one. But this first full length album contains a track called Gemini, which I'm very fond of, and you'll hear use of drum and bass breaks. At the time in the late 90s, drum and bass was probably the hottest club music going. And yeah, just listen to this, and you can see how it might have influenced an album that would become Kid A. We'll be right back.
I have Did you know that you can support Co-op Radio when you use Ride Austin? Nonprofit Ride Austin, created with Austin values in mind, helps harness the giving spirit of the Austin community. When you ride local with Ride Austin, you can round up your fare and designate Co-op Radio to receive your donation. For more information and to download the Ride Austin app, you may visit rideaustin.com.
Support comes from Fantastic Fest 2018, September 20th to 27th at the Alamo Drafthouse on South Lamar. Fantastic Fest showcases over 70 premier international features and 40 shorts of science fiction, fantasy, horror, animation, crime, and Asian cinema. Blasting off the festival in its 14th year will be the premiere of David Gordon Green's razor-sharp contribution to the Halloween canon with legendary actor Jamie Lee Curtis in attendance. Other highlights include premieres of Hold the Dark with Jeffrey Wright, the reality-wrecking epic Climax, and an open-air screening of Border. More information at fantasticfest.com.
Support comes from the Austin Public Library and AISD, now offering student library cards with access to homework help, research material, books, movies, music, games, and the virtual library. Details at library.austintexas.gov/AISD card.
Welcome back.
Thanks for hanging in there. This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. You're streaming us live at koop.org or on your fancy HD radio.
Yeah. Right?
Have you heard about those things?
I've heard about it. I haven't seen one yet.
You can get one in your car that tunes in the alternate signal. So if you could drive in your car, and if you got the updated radio, you can flip it over. I heard when I was doing a phone shift during the membership drive, one of the guys working with me said he upgraded his radio to one of those, and he felt like he was tapping into pirate radio, listening to things he shouldn't be allowed to listen to. Right before the break there, we had Cat Power with Crossbone Style, a track off of Moon Picks, which was recorded in Australia and released in 1998. It was the one where Sean Marshall had a nervous breakdown in the house in upstate New York that she had and cordoned herself off into a room with her cat and a tape recorder and wrote about six or so songs, which became the backbone of Moon Picks. And she convinced Matador to send her to Australia to record this album. And she was outfitted with a band while she was there, another great Matador band, the Dirty Three, another early post-rock group. And what came out was probably the most emotionally moving album I've ever heard, which is Moon Picks by Cat Power. I've talked about her before on this show, so I won't eat up the rest of our time talking about it, but it's killer stuff. If you're ever going through a breakup or a hard time in your life, her voice will definitely take you higher. Moving right on down the line, though, with the story of Matador, next thing we have is Spoon. When I moved to Austin, roughly about 1995, within a year or so, I was into this band Spoon. Another year goes by, they're on Matador, they got an album out. To me, they were the biggest band in the world. In hindsight, I don't think they were selling so hot for Matador. I'm sure it was very rough for them, probably still working day jobs. But for me and my friends, we felt like we had the new Pixies in our hometown or whatever. Like we felt like we were as lucky as if we had lived in Liverpool in 1962 and 63 and gotten to see the Beatles at the Cavern Club. That's how we felt every time we went and saw Spoon on a random Tuesday night at the Electric Lounge. So this is one of my favorite tracks off their debut album, which was called Telefono. It came out in 1996. I remember it was on the shelf in Sound Exchange over on the Drag for a long time. They were selling it for an unbeatable price on vinyl. So that was how I first got my hands on it, because it was like, oh man, I can afford this. I think it was like $5 for a full LP on vinyl at the time. Of course, later that album went out of print. It was unbelievably expensive until it got reissued later. But at the time, it was very cheap. I was able to afford both lunch and an album that day when I bought Telefono. So here's one of my favorite cuts, as I said, off this record. This is called Idiot Driver.
Driver. just makes me fresh. Reckless the highway is your girlfriend, and it goes by quick. It goes, Eddie and Driver, Eddie and Drive. I'm stuck all alone, and I wanna turn over. We'll be right back.
wandering gets you done. Nobody gives you a chance or a dollar in this old town. Hunger and silence from you is a giveaway. Squalor and smoke's not your style. I don't like this place, we better go. Then I compare notes with your older sister. I am a lazy cat, she is as pure as the cold driven snow. Takes a back seat as a cigarette catches and sets off the smoke alarm. What do you make of the cool set in London? You're constantly updating your hit parade of your 10 biggest wanks. She's a waitress and she's got style.
Did you know that you can support Co-op Radio when you use Ride Austin? Nonprofit Ride Austin, created with Austin values in mind, helps harness the giving spirit of the Austin community. When you ride local with Ride Austin, you can round up your fare and designate Co-op Radio to receive your donation. For more information and to download the Ride Austin app, you may visit rideaustin.com. Co-op would like to thank the following businesses for their donation of food to sustain our volunteers during our membership drive.
Threadgill's Old Number 1, 6416 North Lamar, Austin.
Counterculture, 2337 East Cesar Chavez.
The ABGB, 1305 West Oltorf.
Cherrywood Coffee House at 1400 East 38th and a Half Street.
Manja Pizza, 12001 Burnett Road, Suite D.
A Plus A, Sichuan China, 13376 Research Boulevard.
Garden Spot, 9415 Burnett Road.
Eastside Pies, 5312 Airport Boulevard, Suite G, Austin.
Thundercloud Subs, 13776 Research Boulevard.
Empanadas, 1924 East 38th and a Half Street.
Doggy Style Vegan Hot Dogs, 603 West Live Oak Street.
Batch Craft Beer and Kolaches, 3220 Manor Road.
Oh yeah, I groove out to that song.
We had a good time. We had three in a row. We don't usually do that on this show because we like talking so much. Yeah, we had right after Idiot Driver, which we spoke of, we had From a Motel 6 from the Yola Tango 1993 album Painful, another band I think of when I think of Matador, is the good old Yola Tango, one of my favorite live bands.
Love them.
And then right after that, we had The Boy with the Arab Strap from Bella and Sebastian's 1998 masterpiece, The Boy with the Arab Strap. We had the title track. So you had something you wanted to bring up?
Is that right? I was just going to say, you know, stay tuned, folks, because after Chasing Sound, you know, the thing you're listening to right now, is Diamonds and Iron with Blacksmith, The Blacksmith. Tonight he's doing 6 Degrees of Wino, which is in anticipation of the Wino Heavy birthday special he's doing next Monday. So stay tuned, folks, to KOOP.org.
Absolutely. You're streaming Chasing Sound right now. We're going to have to play our way out of here. This is a band that came very late to Matador. They were on another record label, Interscope, I believe it was, for ages. And it was just one of those things. Matador has now got so much power and clout that they can snag really huge bands. So the last track we're going to play for you tonight is by Queens of the Stone Age. They had an album back in 2014 that surprisingly came out on Matador. And that means they qualify for tonight's show. So we're going nice. We're gonna play out tonight with a track called My God is the Sun from the 2014 album Like Clockwork.